Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and this is episode CLXII, Anthology of Interest III. In this episode, I am joined by three guests. Firstly, Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, who is the head of the Department of Languages and Linguistics at La Trobe University. Secondly, Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport. He's a research fellow in Roman history at Macquarie University and a Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. And finally, last but not least, Dr. Gillian Shepherd, Director of the Trendel Centre at La Trobe University. In this episode, we each present three items of Roman interest for vaguely 3 minutes each. It was recorded in front of a live Zoom audience on the 24th of March 2021, so please forgive the dodgy Zoom sound quality and the slightly chaotic proceedings. We begin with Rhiannon Evans. Hello to everyone who's tuned in around the world. Thank you for stopping by and spending the show with us today. Who would like to get started? Rhiannon, did you say you've got something to do with suicide to give us a nice cheery start?
Beginning, I can do that, which is not quite as depressing as it sounds in some ways. I want to take you back to the year 101 CE to talk about a writer who I'm not sure if people will have heard of, Caelius Italicus. He wrote the longest poem in ancient Latin literature. He was possibly somebody who dobbed people in to Nero, so not the life of a poet who left politics behind. And in 101, he killed himself, apparently by starvation, because he had an unbearably painful corn, or possibly tumour. We're really not certain. It depends on how you translate it. A corn doesn't sound like enough to me. So anyway, the pain was too much for him. He was in his 70s. We know about this from a letter of Pliny the Younger, you know, he who also wrote about Vesuvius erupting in 79 CE and famously wrote about his uncle, Pliny the Elder, dying there. But in another letter, if anyone wants to look it up, it's book 3, letter 7, he wrote this. And I'm going to cheat now. I'm going to do a lot of this, I'm sorry, by reading out extracts from the letter to illustrate what I've just been saying. So Pliny says, "News has just come that Caelius Italicus has starved himself to death at his villa near Neapolis," so near Naples, where he lived undoubtedly in a lot of luxury. I'm editorializing. Oh, by the way, I meant to mention about Caelius Italicus that he also was obsessed with the poet Virgil and had a little shrine to Virgil at probably this very villa near Naples, where he basically carried out a religious ceremony on Virgil's birthday and treated him like a god. Whether you'd say that's a more positive side to him, but certainly, treating Virgil like a god, I think is fair enough in some ways, perhaps more positive than dobbing people into Nero. To continue with Pliny, ill health was the cause assigned. He had an incurable tumor. I'm going to go with tumor because I think that, you know, if you're going to starve yourself to death, which sounds awful, then it would be for something serious, which made him weary of life and resolved him to face death with a determination that nothing could shake. Clearly, Pliny really admires this at this stage. But then he undercuts it with that information that I've just given you. He says, during Nero's reign, Caelius had injured his reputation, which is a very political way of putting it, I think, for it was thought that he voluntarily informed against people. I mean, Caelius dies in 101, so this is under the Emperor Trajan, which seems like an awfully long way from Nero. But back in the days of Nero, back before 68 CE, he had been somebody who would go to Nero with information, which would be really dangerous for those people. You know, Nero quite unstable during his reign. So he's certainly not a character that is entirely positive. But in this letter, Pliny kind of celebrates his life, albeit measuring it a little bit, and gives us this information about this character, which my students always find kind of incredible, that somebody would just have the determination, as Pliny calls it, to just stop, to just say, I've had enough. We have other tales of people deciding they don't want to continue with life, or being told, indeed, by someone like Nero that they shouldn't continue with life. And usually they will stab themselves or take poison or do something that, you know, brings this to an end fairly quickly. But deciding you're just not going to eat anymore and it will take a long time means that I think Caelius is at least an interesting character. And I do recommend that people go read his Punica, if you can bear, the longest poem in Latin literature. I'm sure I've talked for at least 3 minutes there, Matt.
Slightly over. That's okay. We won't dock you too many marks. Do you buy the suicide? Because that seems to be... How do you starve yourself to death?
I believe everything Pliny tells us implicitly. I mean, it's possible there's a lot more going on medically than Pliny talks about. And so it's quite likely that he was ill and couldn't eat, or the illness made him not feel like eating because it was the tumor, you know, goodness knows what was going on. And he's a relatively old man by this point. So I believe that Pliny believes it. There's a political answer.
Do you think, Rhiannon, that starving himself to death was some way of self-punishment, sort of atonement for all the wrongs he had done at all?
What a lovely thought. Yes. I think that if he really had done that, then he probably deserved a bit of suffering later on. Some who've read his poem would say he deserved to suffer for that, which is unfair. It's very unfair. You know, he's not read in the same way that Ovid is read. It's not that easy to find a translation. But that's a good point. I like that, Caelan.
All right. I do not have a segue for that topic. Caelan, do you have a segue at all?
Well, I do, because I also have a death, but it's not a suicide. And this returns us to the world of Faustina the Younger, who was the subject of one of our recent Empress podcasts. And because I was speaking for too long, Matt said I couldn't talk about this anecdote, quite rightly too, because I was going on for too long. But he said I could include it in the Anthology of Interest. So in the second century CE again, about 60 years later than the period Rhiannon was talking about, in the period of the Antonines. And I'm going to talk about what happened when Matidia the Younger died around 162 or 163, early in the reign of Marcus Aurelius. Matidia was Antonine royalty. So she's the great niece of Trajan, the half-sister of Sabina, the wife of Hadrian, and also the great aunt to both Faustina the Younger and her husband Marcus Aurelius. And when she died, Marcus Aurelius granted her the honor of a public funeral. She was probably in her late 70s. She probably died of natural causes. Now, Matidia never married or had children, to our knowledge, but she was very wealthy. She was in many ways a matriarch of the Antonine dynasty at this period. Faustina the Younger's own mother had died early in the reign of Antoninus Pius. So Matidia had very good relations with both Faustina the Younger and also with her daughters, Lucilla and Galeria Faustina. And we know that these girls often stayed with Matidia at her villa when she was growing up. So we get a picture here of some of the female networks within the imperial family and at the imperial court, which we don't often hear about. And we know, thanks to the correspondence of Fronto, who was tutor to the Emperor Marcus Aurelius and also to his co-emperor Lucius Verus, that a complicated legal battle ensued at Matidia's death. As I said, you know, she didn't have any children, and she had actually fallen prey to legacy hunters. So this was an endemic problem we hear in the Roman world, people who try and cozy up to dying widows or widowers in order to be entered into their will. Now, Matidia had bequeathed some money or entered into her will some of these legacy hunters in codicils, which are attachments to the will. So she had originally sealed up the codicils, but then at some point she changed her mind. So she didn't want these legacy hunters to inherit. So she broke the seal, which would invalidate the will. However, when Matidia died, the legacy hunters very cleverly resealed the codicils to say that they were valid and then presented them to the Emperor Marcus Aurelius to rule on their case. Now, if their case was declared valid, and that they should inherit some of Matidia's fortune. Then precious family jewels, heirlooms of the Antonine house, would have to be sold to pay for their inheritance as the will decreed. And these are jewels which had been promised to Faustina and her daughter. So this is a major controversy for the imperial house, because Marcus Aurelius, the emperor, has to rule on the issue. And we know about the case because of the letters which Marcus exchanged with Fronto, in which the emperor sought his advice of his former teacher. And they had a question before them. If the jewels need to be sold to pay for the inheritance so that the legacy hunters can receive money, should Faustina buy them? Because they want these jewels. But if so, would Faustina then be accused of perhaps buying them at cut price value and then selling the legacy hunters short? So, you know, should the emperor and his wife benefit personally? You know, Caesar's wife must be above suspicion and all that. So it was a very serious case for the image of the Antonine family. Marcus even wrote to his co-emperor, Lucius Verus, who was in Syria at the time for his Parthian campaign, to ask for his advice. Now, unfortunately, we don't know the outcome. Fronto's letters don't contain the ending to the story. But I think it's a really interesting case of both the female networks, relationships that can develop within the imperial house, as well as some of the thorny issues which emperors were called to decide upon.
Very good. It sounds like there's a lot of respect for the Roman law from Marcus Aurelius if he just didn't go and fob these guys off.
Definitely, definitely. So there was a law called the Lex Falcidia, which decreed the rules concerning the estates and inheritance. And it was quite a difficult issue. And Marcus Aurelius is known for judging cases fairly from other sources. You know, it's also a question of the image of the household. Do they want to be seen to be benefiting personally from this?
I can segue to any topic on death, it seems, because all of my topics tonight involve death. For my first topic, I'm going to be talking about the Sibylline books, which are oracle verses which were consulted when Rome was going through some sort of monumental crisis. And I found these really interesting because the Romans never really shirked away from executing criminals or, you know, treating slaves like they were property. And so, you know, death wasn't a terrible concept for them, but there were actually instances where they practiced human sacrifice. And there were three cases where this happened, and they were all dictated by the Sibylline books. And I found this interesting for a couple of reasons, mostly because the Roman authors that we've got are really hard on the Druids for practicing the same things. Rhiannon, was it Tacitus who kind of advocated that Druids are okay to be wiped out so that they don't practice human sacrifice? And yet here are the Romans doing that sort of thing. So the three instances where this happened, we've got 228 BCE, when this is after the First Punic War. The Gauls are being a bit opportunistic and are gathering on the horizon. It's looking really bad for Rome there. 216 BCE, around the defeat of the Battle of Cannae. And we've got another one which is a bit later than that. So pretty much they're facing military defeat. They consult the Sibylline books, and the Sibylline books says, "Don't worry, guys, I've got you covered. I've got the solution. All you have to do is sacrifice four people, a Greek man and woman and a Gallic man and woman." And I don't know how this would have gone down once you get into like the second century CE, when you've got Gauls and Greeks well integrated into the empire. But, you know, back in Republic days, you can maybe fudge the numbers a bit. And it called for a bloodless sacrifice. So this was buried alive in the Forum Boarum. And I imagine that they kind of held their nose and did that. The records that we've got say that they did, and Plutarch in the Life of Marcellus says that still to this day, in the month of November, they perform mysterious and secret ceremonies because they did these sacrifices, which I imagine is some sort of atonement. So yeah, the Sibylline books are really interesting that way. They tell the Romans to do things that are really clear and succinct. We've got none of it left. We know that they were written in verse. We've got a strange legend of how King Tarquinius got them, which is nice, but that's, you know, another of interest altogether, which I don't have at the moment. But, you know, it's things like plague in 293 BCE, no problem. You need to impolt the cult of Asclepius and build a temple, and that was on the island that's in the middle of the Tiber. That's nice and straightforward. But then they've also got human sacrifice. And the other thing about the Sibylline books is they don't really seem to be an imperial era thing. Rhiannon and Kaelin, you can maybe weigh in on this, but the last time I see it being referenced is Nero consulting them after the Great Fire of Rome.
I haven't really thought about or sort of noticed that they stopped being mentioned, but I mean, we do know that Augustus kind of culled them and edited them into a form that he was happy with, that presumably said the things he wanted them to say. So they were clearly useful stroke controversial stroke potentially dangerous in the early imperial period, but you know, that's a time of trauma and change and trying to heal Roman society, so they're clearly regarded as important there.
I do have a late example. So in Lactantius's On the Deaths of the Persecutors, he tells us that Maxentius consults the Sibylline books before, as Constantine is marching to Rome. This is before the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in 312. That is a late appearance there. And obviously Constantine's a Christian emperor, and so things change after that. But they're still used by emperors in these moments of crisis. And it may be that we don't hear about them so much because of the nature of our sources for, say, the second and third centuries. It's certainly an interesting reminder that, you know, even if this didn't happen, you know, Plutarch says it was still celebrated as if it did happen. I mean, I think it's one of those interesting reminders that the Romans really weren't like us. You know, every time we think we can identify with them, you know, they do something like that that makes them seem foreign and quite strange.
He wasn't the only author to talk about it. It's in Pliny's Natural Histories as well, when he talks about magic and how they use different parts of the human body. Sacrifice. And it's also in Livy as well, so it wasn't just Plutarch who was writing about it. And I guess the only other instance that I've come across of of burying a human alive is it happened to a Vestal Virgin during the time of Domitian, but that was just Domitian. Did you want to jump in with a thing of interest, Gillian?
Yeah, I would. Well, let me start off with the one that is not as boring as you might think it would be, and that's Roman concrete. Now, there's an awful lot of it out there, because it's so tough, it really survives. It was one of the Romans' greatest inventions, and it meant they could build just about anything everywhere. And I don't know, I think you're talking about Nero's Great Fire of Rome. That enabled Nero, of course, to build the Domus Aurea, the Golden House, and that's one of the sort of wackiest buildings because it exploits all these strange shapes in concrete. But we think it was something that was actually invented in the second century BCE. And while there are a lot of variations on the concrete recipe, depending on what your local resources were, a really good one involves something called pulvis putulanus or pozzolana, which is volcanic sand from around the Bay of Naples area. And the advantage of this volcanic sand is that it makes your concrete waterproof. So when you mix it with the other stuff, the lime, the water, the quartz sand, this stuff will set underwater. So it's brilliant for building bridges and jetties and that kind of stuff. But you also need your really essential ingredient, which is aggregate. And the aggregate could vary, bits of stone or broken up bits of tile or brick, depending on what you had to hand. But that is what would give it its structural stability. But unlike the architects of the 1970s, the Romans did not like to look at their concrete. They always faced it with something. And we can get a good idea of the date of a building from the type of facing they used. So the very earliest concrete uses something called opus incertum, uncertain work, if you like. And concrete itself is opus carmenticium, cement work. Opus incertum is just irregular bits of stone facing the concrete. Then they get a bit jazzier in the late Republic and just into the imperial period with opus reticulatum. That's where you see that diamond cross-shaped pattern you so often see at Roman sites. And then a bit later on, they get into opus latericium, which is where they use tiles, those thin Roman tiles. And of course, you can always have opus mixtum, which is stone and tiles. Now, that still wasn't enough. Then you need a nice thick layer of plaster and you might paint that, or if you're really, really posh, you would revet it in marble. Now, of course, all that has been stripped off since, because one of the first things that happened in later centuries was all this fantastic marble just disappeared. And there are an awful lot of fancy churches and palaces and things like that around Europe that are kitted out with this marble. So it was an amazingly useful material. And there are two really good buildings in Rome, if we ever get to travel overseas again, that I would recommend as you want to see good bits of Roman concrete. One is a pile of rubble in the sort of back gardens of some blocks of flats in the area of Rome, now known as Monte Testaccio. And it is possibly to be identified with one of our very earliest concrete buildings, and that is the Porticus Aemilia, the huge warehouse that was built in the 2nd century BCE. And it's a sign of the enormous trade that was coming up the Tiber into Rome, even at this period. And it supposedly was about 50 sort of bays long. It went for nearly half a kilometre, this vast, vast thing. And its walls, if we've got the right building identified, are about 1.4 metres thick. That's its exterior walls. So it's absolutely massive structure. No wonder bits of it are still there, frankly. And the other really cool one is where you can also buy the most expensive drink and expensive gelati in Rome, and that's the Pantheon. That is one of our best preserved Roman buildings, and it is an entirely concrete building. The aggregate gets lighter as the building goes up. So you start off with a very heavy aggregate in the bottom, in the foundations, basalt. It gets lighter and lighter until you get that fabulous dome of the Pantheon. And that's actually pumice, that very light volcanic stone you scrub your feet in the bath with. That's what's forming the aggregate of the dome. So it's an incredibly flexible and versatile medium. And there's still studies being done, just trying to work out how Roman concrete really works and why it lasts for so long. But it was good stuff.
In regards to the Pantheon, that would have been intentional that you start off with a heavy kind of aggregate and then...
Yeah, you are lessening the load. It has no internal supports. It's this fabulous, huge dome that it wasn't until well into the modern period that a dome of that diameter was exceeded. So you need to reduce the load on it as much as possible as you go up. That's right.
Well, there you go. Good on Apollodorus of Damascus then. So one of my favourite Julian stories is I said to her one time, oh, let's do a podcast on the construction of the Colosseum, which was a whole episode on Roman concrete, as it turned out. Also interviewing you about the Palatine Hill. Julian, what's your favourite part of the Palatine Hill? Oh, let me show you all the photos of this concrete wall that I took.
It was a great trial because I happened to come across precisely the bit of wall that I'd been using a rubbish black and white photograph in a book to demonstrate to students how a wall was constructed. And then I thought, I've got to get a bit of photo for myself. And then purely by chance, I came across exactly the bit of wall which has all the best bits in it, right, even down to the holes where they pegged in the marble.
There you go. Best bit of the wall. All right. Thank you very much for that. Who has a of interest that they'd like to go with next?
Let's go to Britannia, to the very edges of the empire. And in fact, this is partly me wanting to relive some of my own travel history, given that we can't travel at the moment. And the last time I went overseas, I did go to Northern Britain and I went to visit Vindolanda, which a lot of listeners will know about because we then recorded an episode on Vindolanda. So this is a fort very close to Hadrian's Wall, although it predates Hadrian's Wall. So in Northern England, one of the things Vindolanda is famous for is that letters and other documents have been found there, which is really special. These are written on wooden tablets, and the fact that they've been preserved, they've survived in rubbish pits and apparently survived some kind of burn, which is to do with the local conditions and temperature and amount of dampness. And we're very, very lucky. A lot of these are inventory lists, and I've trawled through a lot of them, and they're kind of interesting in terms of, you know, what people needed on this fort. But I don't want to just read you out lists of how much corn and wine and honey and whatever it was they were ordering in or selling out. The most famous one I talked about in that episode, which is the birthday invitation of a woman called Claudia Severa, and is the first known handwriting by a woman that we have. But I wanted to talk about a couple of other ones, which I think are a little bit amusing. One of them shows us that the Romans who were posted up there were collecting ethnographic information themselves on the native Britons, and that they did not have a very high opinion of the natives, of my dear ancestors, and maybe even building a database on how to fight against them. And this is very fragmentary, like a lot of these wooden tablets, but I'll read you what it says, because I love it and I'll editorialize a bit. It says, the Britons are unprotected by armor, at least we think it says by armor, unprotected in some way, and it's clearly to do with warfare. They have too many cavalry, he says. He's having a bit of a go at them. They need more inventory. And these cavalry, he reckons, actually, I'm presuming it's written by a man. It might not be. This person says these cavalry don't use swords. And then he uses this word Britunculi, which means little Britons. These wretched little Britons, it's often translated, sit on their horses to throw javelins. And he's clearly implying to no great effect. I think this document, if it's a letter or a memo, whatever it is, it's very fragmentary, so we can't tell the context, is clearly about, we don't really need to worry about them. They're just going to go around on their horses and mess things up. You know, you can take them down with a javelin because they're not wearing armor. They don't know how to throw javelins, so they can't even use the advantage of being at a distance. Clearly not very effective fighters, really no respect for the Britons at all. And just one other one briefly, because I love it so much, which shows us that the soldiers up there were possibly underdressed and certainly needed help. And it's a letter from somebody else to presumably a soldier who is stationed at Vindolanda. I have sent you, then gap, unknown number, pairs of socks, really vital in Northern England in winter, but also two pairs of sandals, presumably for summer, and two pairs of underpants. So underpants vital. And then the letter ends with, say hello to Elpis and Tetricus and all your tent mates. I hope you all live together with the greatest good fortune, along with your socks, is the implication. It's my favorite letter, I think, even over the birthday one. Just, here are the socks, you need socks.
Okay, very good. Well, I've got one that can directly segue into that if I can jump line, Kaelin, if that's okay.
Oh, no worries, no worries.
Because I've got curse tablets. Tablets of another kind. Curse tablets, thin sheets of lead with writing scratched in tiny letters, rolled and folded, pierced with nails, buried in the ground or in a burial, thrown in a well or in a pool. So essentially, if you've got a grudge, if you've got somebody that you can want to hurt, you can sure go and make a sacrifice or an offering or something like that, or you can put it down on a curse tablet. And they were called tablets, but you know, they were more kind of curse scrolls, I guess. Put it down on this scroll, roll them up, and then put it somewhere significant, such as, you know, maybe the walls of the foundation of the house that they live in or something like that, or in a pool or something like this. Some of these were prepared in advance, which I like to think you can go down to the market and buy a curse and then just fill in the name or have the name filled in. And some of them are really obvious, this kind of thing. And some of them included hair and they functioned as a bit of a love spell. So I guess, you know, you got to go and get some hair of the person that you want the spell to work on, roll it up in this and that will work. And, you know, you ask the gods or places or spirits for a bit of help in extracting some vengeance on this. So a lot of these have been found around the place. They've got about 1,500 of them. A good place for them is actually in southwest Britain, in Bath, where they've found 130 curse tablets. Most of them were excavated in the early 1980s. Most of these are to do with the restitution for stolen goods, but one of them is also very brutal and graphic. Tassatia, hereby accursed, is labelled old like putrid gore. And this was found in a Briton grave, and the writing was backwards, which could make it more potent. But my favourite ones of these are the people, and, you know, I don't get this, but there are some people out there who are really passionate about their sports. I am clearly not one of these people. This one was found in modern-day Tunisia, and it's dating to the late empire. I conjure you, demon, whoever you may be, and order you to torture and kill from this hour, this day, this moment, the horses of the green and the white teams. Kill and smash the charioteers, Clarus, Felix, Primulus, Romanus. Do not leave a breath in them. I conjure you by him who has been delivered you at the time, the gods of the sea and the air. So that's somebody who's got some sort of grudge against two chariot teams in particular and want the horses to die. Or maybe he's just laid a really big bet. Another one in kind of the same sort of vein, which is another sporting related curse scroll. Entangle the nets of Vincenius Zanio. May he be unable to chain bears. May he lose with every bear, and may he be unable to kill a bear on Wednesday in any hour. Now, quickly make it happen. That, I think, was targeted at a gladiator who was going to be fighting bears. And again, you do that if you make a bet against him. So yeah, hoping that Zorizo the gladiator is killed by Goldflake and Innocence. There we go. That's my little of interest on curse tablets.
I think there's a line for Hallmark there in these prepared curses, don't you? In these days when we're not sending so many cards anymore.
Oh yeah, happy birthday, putrid gore. That's an untapped market.
Of course, chariot racing was big business, and you know, these were like, you know, the teams like the Blues and the Greens. These were like, you know, the AFL teams of late antiquity, and people were ready to die for their teams and barrack for them. And as you quite rightly said, Matt, they'd also put large bets on them. We actually have a gambling machine from Constantinople from the Byzantine period, which survives. Now it's in the museum in Berlin. They were really fanatical about them, but I didn't know they would also place curses on their opponents as well.
Yeah, look, I can't imagine doing it myself when it's something to do with sport, but I kind of think, you know, I would gladly fill out a curse tablet for somebody who posts a spoiler for WandaVision on Twitter. Ye oldie, unfollow. All right, Kaelin, what's your second one?
I do have a segue from this, so we're also going in that we're still in the world of gods and dedications. Unusual dedications, offerings to the gods. These are obviously dedications for good things to happen to the individual and to the Roman state. And of course, Roman generals were known after they had been off conquering and rampaging in foreign lands to bring the spoils back to Rome, display them in triumph, and then dedicate them to the gods as well. And I have some quite interesting dedications made by Roman emperors. My first one was by Nero. He made a couple of interesting dedications. Firstly, we know he was of the theatrical and literary bent. He dedicated some of his poems to Capitoline Jupiter. He had them inscribed in gold, Suetonius tells us, in the life of Nero. And interestingly, also to celebrate his manhood, Suetonius tells us that he shaved his first beard to the accompaniment of a splendid sacrifice of bullocks. This is Suetonius, Life of Nero, chapter 12. Put it in a golden box adorned with pearls of great price and dedicated in the capital. Nero is saying, here I am, I'm coming to manhood, I can rule Rome properly, and he's going to make a dedication of the first shavings of his beard to Jove there as well. And so, you know, these dedications were made in the hope of a good outcome for an emperor's reign. And this is what the short-lived emperor Galba hoped would happen when he was making dedications. He was one of the year of the four emperors. So he ruled after Nero's suicide in 68 CE to early in 69. We know that he was rummaging through the jewelry and the treasure on the Palatine, and he found a necklace fashioned of pearls and precious stones, Suetonius tells us in the Life of Galba, chapter 18. And he wanted to adorn the statue of Fortuna, good fortune, at Tusculum with this necklace. So the idea that, you know, this would lead to a long and prosperous and happy reign. However, he decided on an impulse, Suetonius tells us, to dedicate the jewelry instead to Capitoline Venus. And because of this, Suetonius says, and I quote, the next night Fortune appeared to him in his dreams, complaining of being robbed of the gift intended for her and threatening in her turn to take away what she had bestowed. When Galba hastened in terror to Tusculum at daybreak to offer sacrifices because of the dream and sent on men to make preparations for the ceremony, he found on the altar nothing but warm ashes, and beside it an old man dressed in black, holding the incense in a glass dish and the wine in an earthen cup. And this, so says Suetonius, was one of the omens that foretold that Galba would not have a long reign, because he decided at last minute to switch the deity to whom he was dedicating the jewels. And of course, he was murdered in early 69 CE. One of the other interesting dedications was made by the Emperor Hadrian, so who was known for his love affair with Bithynian youth Antinous, and they quite often went out hunting together. Their love affair and their hunting expeditions were subsequently celebrated in poetry. But we know that Hadrian once dedicated a bear skin, the skin of a bear that he had killed on a hunt, to Eros, the god of love or desire, at Thespia in Greece, and he had a poem inscribed on the dedication. He said, "O archer child of clear-voiced Aphrodite, dwelling in Thespiae by the blooming garden of Narcissus, be gracious and accept what Hadrian offers, the spoils of his hunt, a she-bear which he slew himself with a cast from horseback. And in exchange for this, may you chastely breathe favour upon him from heavenly Aphrodite." A dedication which is probably associated with the burgeoning romance between Hadrian and Antinous, and a desire that it continues under Aphrodite's blessing. My favourite one, however, takes us back to the late Republic, and this is a dedication made by Cicero. We know about this thanks to Plutarch in his Moralia. When Cicero dedicated a silver goblet to the gods, he caused the engraver to cut the letters of his first two names, so Marcus Tullius, but instead of Cicero, to engrave a chickpea. Cicero comes from Kikare, a chickpea. So there's a nice little drawing of the chickpea on that goblet, which unfortunately doesn't survive. But there we go. Interesting and unusual dedications to the gods.
So it's interesting that they persevered with that sort of thing, even though they weren't always effective. So you've got Galba essentially having his reign cut short, being attributed to that. Antinous didn't fare well. And yet, you know, you just kind of chalk that up to asking the wrong god or asking the wrong thing, or...
Yes, you always need to persevere. You just may have done it wrong. Yes, you need to find the right god to help you.
Okay, Rhiannon, I think you're next.
I'll be very quick, but I am doing ethnography again. I'm travelling to the other end of the empire, to Egypt, which is a land of wonder for both the Greeks and the Romans. Herodotus talks about it. There's a whole book on Egypt where he talks about it being largely the opposite of everything Greece. And the Romans kind of continue this trend, but I want to fly the flag of another obscure author, Pomponius Mela. Lots of fun. I wrote about him in my PhD, not just about him. But this is one of my favorite passages of Pomponius Mela, who was a what we call a chorographer. He wrote a sort of geography in three books, quite short, probably during the reign of Caligula, possibly slightly later. And he wrote about the Nile, which was a big mystery to the ancients. They didn't understand how it flooded in summer. How did this happen? And he gives it all of these really supernatural qualities. So a lot of writers, Pliny and Strabo, other geographical writers, talk about the Nile as something extraordinary, but he makes it actually produce life. He says that Egypt is devoid of rain, amazingly fertile, and a very prolific producer of human beings and other animals. The Nile produces them from the soil. He says the Nile is behind this fertility, as it is the largest river that makes its way into our sea. He means the Mediterranean, of course, because we own it. He says a little bit later that when the Nile stops flooding, certain organisms are seen, not yet completely formed. They take their first breath when they are still earthen in part. So he thinks that the soil actually, because it's been flooded by the Nile, it creates beings, organisms out of the soil, that's how magical it is. He has lots of complex theories about why the Nile floods in summer. The best one is that there is a southern hemisphere. He's not the only person to theorize this, to be fair. He says the river originating in those Antichthonian lands, all right, so basically us here in Australia, emerges in ours. The reason he thinks that that's important is because he thinks it is a different season there. So he actually gets this right, that it's winter in the southern hemisphere and that there's some secret channel the Nile goes through and it comes out in the north. And that's why it flows so freely from May to August. So he sort of, by some weird coincidence, sort of got something right. That's not the reason that the Nile floods in summer. We know that now. But he's sort of building on this feeling already that Egypt is this weird place of wonders in this quite wonderful way.
Was that a very common kind of point of view? I mean, he seems to have guessed things right.
No, the more common theories are about strange things going on up in the mountains, snow melt, which I think is closer to the truth, but it's a mystery to be solved. You know, the Romans were always sending people up there to go and try and find the source of the Nile, and they never quite could. There are various theories, not all of which I understand. I could read them to you, but I'm not sure reading them out is very interesting. And also there are lots more exciting things to get onto. But they really didn't know, and they were guessing pretty much because it was different to every other river.
All right, very good. In the interest of catching things up, Gillian, did you want to go again?
It might sort of segue in some ways about strange things, because actually what I might talk about is Roman sea monsters. Now, there are lots of hazards of Roman seafaring. Of course, the Romans did a lot of that. They had this empire. It's the best way to get around, important for trade. There was shipwrecks, obviously, the pirates, that Pompey supposedly cleared those out. But the thing the Romans really couldn't control was the sea monsters. Now, of course, we know about sea monsters from mythology a lot, the famous story of Perseus rescuing Andromeda from the sea monster. And that was a myth that was depicted a lot in Roman wall paintings. But the Romans were also quite clear that there were real sea monsters. And we get that coming through in a work by Oppian, who's a second century CE Greco-Roman poet, who writes a story called the Haliutica, which is actually an epic poem on fishing. And it's partly practical advice on fishing and partly kind of, they sort of anthropomorphizes these fish. They can have friendships, they can get jealous, they can fall in love, all sorts of things like that. But he says in it, in book one, he says, the sea monsters, mighty of limb, the wonders of the sea, heavy with strength, invincible, a terror for the eyes to behold and ever armed with deadly rage. Many of these there be that roam the spacious seas. And one of these was apparently displayed in Rome in 58 BCE by the aedile Marcus Scaurus. Now, I think on another occasion, Rhiannon talked about Scaurus's theatre. Yep. Well, part of that sort of showing off in 58 BCE was to put on this display of the bones of the very monster which was threatening Andromeda, which he had apparently discovered at Joppa in Judea. And Pliny says that bones exceeded 40 feet in length, and they were higher than that of an Indian elephant, and the backbone was a foot and a half in thickness. So he's putting on this big show, but what was he showing? And it's actually quite possible that Scaurus had got hold of some huge set of bones, maybe whale bones. Whales are known in the Mediterranean, particularly the fin and minke whales. But the Romans, while they knew about whales, probably wouldn't have seen them alive much, simply because they tended to coast hug in their sailing. They didn't really go into the deep waters where the whales are. So where they saw the whales, they're probably more likely to have seen them washed up as carcasses and sort of half rotten on the beach. But from some of the other ancient descriptions we get of sea monsters, they're all sort of frothing and churning at the mouth. That does sound a bit like the way a baleen wave, one of the whales with the sieve in its mouth, the way it feeds, it comes to the surface. Another candidate might be an oarfish. This is a fish that's still rarely seen today, but it's a huge, thick, long thing with a red crest on it. And that, in fact, might have inspired the two serpents that we hear about in Virgil's Aeneid, the ones who kill Laocoon, who's trying to persuade the Trojans that it's really not a good idea to let that horse into Troy. Another explanation is that, and this is applied to terrestrial monsters in mythology as well, is that there's some kind of fossilized remains. There are fossil beds across the Mediterranean. And you can imagine in antiquity, you're quarrying or something, you come across a massive set of dinosaur bones or mammoth bones or whatever. How are you going to explain that? What are you going to do with them? And the idea that it's some kind of monster is perfectly feasible. There might have been a bit more of a charade going on, though, too. We do hear about more elaborate displays of monsters in Rome. One is perhaps not such a scary monster. It's a triton. A triton's sort of really more a form of transport for major sea deities like Neptune, sort of half snaky man sort of thing. And the traveller Pausanias supposedly saw a triton displayed in Rome when he was travelling in the 2nd century CE. And he describes it. He says they have hair like marsh frogs. The rest of their body's rough with fine scales, like a shark. Under their ears, they have gills and a man's nose. They have hands and fingers and nails like the shells of the murex seashell. Under the breast and belly is a tail like a dolphin's instead of feet. Now, this is pretty clearly some kind of composite thing, a bit like the monsters of the medieval period or more recently the famous Piltdown man. But Pausanias loves this sort of thing. He loves these monsters and these stories of big sort of A-list of bones, things like that, lots of bones being on display in the ancient world. And people got to see them, absolutely believed it. It might have been fueled by real sightings of whales or oarfish or whatever, but equally the Romans were ever inventive. So anything for a good show.
It's like the Roman equivalent of P.T. Barnum.
Yes, yeah. There's always been charlatans around. There's always the show-offs, yeah.
Kaylin, I've got a segue, unless you have, and I'm going to show my hand here and you'll probably know exactly what I'm talking about if I say I'm going to talk about lampreys. Yeah, we're all good with lampreys. Okay, so Vettius Pollio was a man of equestrian rank. His father was a freedman and he was very stupidly wealthy. I'm not quite sure why, but he is a good friend of Augustus. So that kind of situates where we are here. We've got a few references to him in ancient texts, and he seems to be somebody who isn't well-behaved, doesn't spend his money well, and just isn't generally nice to people. So one that we've got is from Cicero, who at the time of this was the governor of Cilicia, which is in Turkey. He's writing to his BFF Atticus, and he writes about Vettius Pollio, who comes to visit. He calls him a hair-brained fellow enough, and I don't know what that translates from, but he doesn't seem to like him very much. He says, Vettius came to meet me with two chariots, a carriage and horses, a sedan, a large suite of servants. There was also in the chariot a dog-headed baboon, as well as some wild asses, which were Iranian wild horses. But you've got to think that Vettius is kind of turning up to Turkey with a baboon in his chariot, which is from sub-Saharan Africa. So the guy knew how to travel in style. Cicero continues to say, I never saw a more extravagant fool. But the cream of the whole is this, and this is when he's getting really gossipy to Atticus. A mutual friend of his went through all of Vettius Pollio's baggage. In this are found five small portrait busts of married ladies, among which is the wife of which he had been intimate with, what a fellow, the wife of Lepidus, who was the lesser known member of the Second Triumvirate with Mark Antony and Octavian, as easygoing as his name to take this so calmly. The other thing that we've got concerning Vettius Pollio is a story that one day he was entertaining Augustus and his cupbearer broke a crystal goblet, which is apparently something that you never do. Without regard for his guest, Pollio ordered the fellow to be thrown to the lampreys, are kind of like an eel suckerfish thing that, you know, looks like something out of an alien movie that will latch on and just kind of chew up and off they go. So anyway, he had this slave thrown into the lamprey pool. The slave fell to his knees before Augustus and supplicated him. And Augustus at first tried to persuade Pollio not to commit so monstrous a deed. Pollio didn't listen. The man gets thrown to the lampreys. And I gather that it's not a very pleasant scene to watch. So in punishment, Augustus orders that every crystal goblet be taken out before him and broken in front of Pollio to kind of teach him a bit of a lesson. It's just interesting that, you know, as much as they considered slaves to be property, this was clearly a bit too far for Augustus. You know, you can sure treat your slaves as property, but you don't throw them to the lampreys. So yeah, there you go. That account there was in Dio, but Seneca's written about it as well. And Seneca comes down quite hard on Pollio as somebody who's, you know, too luxurious and too extravagant and takes it a bit too far and drives around in chariots with baboons and busts of the ladies of his conquest. Can you imagine you go and sleep with a married woman and you say, okay, can you hang around for a minute? I just need to get your likeness down. Lovely piece of work there.
He's almost a bit like a Bond villain, isn't he? Like, oh, I could throw you to the lampreys now.
Yeah.
Your time is up.
Lampreys with freaking laser beams on their head. Yes.
Yes. Supposed to show the clemency of Augustus as well, you know, made that sort of transition from, you know, the young butcher Octavian, and then, you know, he reinvents himself as Augustus, this sort of clement and merciful ruler there.
That was the other moral to the story, yes. Gillian, you've got one more of interest.
I do, yes. This is a bit of a dismal one, though I hope you find it interesting. These are the Puticulli of Rome. If you've been to Rome, you might have walked down the fabulous Appian Way lined with tombs or been to the Street of Tombs at Pompeii. And, of course, those are the graves of the relatively affluent people in society who could afford a monument and a nice plum spot buried by a roadside. But a place like Rome had huge urban poor, and a lot of them were homeless. And where did they end up when they died? We know that corpses in the streets were a problem in ancient Rome. It's been estimated that there were maybe up to 1,500 unclaimed dead bodies in Rome per annum. There were signs even stopping you from dumping corpses, and the famous story of a dog dumping a human hand by Vespasian as he was having dinner. So what happened to them? They had to be removed and disposed of somehow. For the Republic, we think one answer might be the so-called Puticulli. Now, we hear about these from Varro, who's writing in the first century BCE, and these are pits outside Roman towns where humans were buried, and he thinks the name comes from the word pute, to stink, or possibly from rotting corpses, putiscabani. And this is in reference also to a place on the Esquiline Hill where corpses were simply abandoned. We also hear about this sort of area from Horace, who in one of his satires is addressing Maecenas. And Maecenas has created the very famous Horti Maeceniatus on the Esquiline Hill. And he's covered over, and it's one of these areas of burial, by dumping a huge amount of earth on it, so he can create his gardens. And Horace says, now you can live on a healthier Esquiline and stroll on the sunny rampart where Sally used to gaze at a grim landscape covered with whitened bones. Now, in the late 19th century, there was a new residential district being built in Rome just outside the Esquiline gate. And the excavator, Rodolfo Lanciani, found 75 big pits full of human remains, but also a lot of other detritus, including animals and even excrement, actually. These were obviously big dumping pits for perhaps the very poor, slaves, victims of an epidemic. But they still were so big, they must have taken weeks or even months to fill. And quite how the Romans tolerated the smell of these things outside the gates of their city is a bit unclear. Lanciani, even in the 19th century, apparently had to give his workers regular breaks because these pits still smelt so much. Now, these are probably not the pits that are being described by Horace, because the ones that Lanciani was describing were filled in probably about maybe 50 years before Horace and Maecenas was creating his garden. But nevertheless, we have a sense of how the Romans disposed in the Republic of perhaps the urban poor or slaves or whoever. Now, these do look like, though, perhaps the Puticulli described by Varro, and they date to about the 3rd to 1st centuries BCE. Around the time that Maecenas was building his garden, though, there was also a senatorial decree that you couldn't cremate anybody's within 2 miles of the city. So it looks like disposing of the dead was becoming a real problem. Now, these are the cremations. These are the cremation pyres. That's the normal way of disposing of the dead. Most well-off Romans would have been cremated. But it suggests it's becoming a real problem. It's becoming a social nuisance to have dead people really just too close to the city. Once this decree happens, though, the cremations are moved further away from the city. We know that, but we don't hear anything more about the Puteoli when we get into the Roman period, and we haven't found any either. So we're still left with this problem of how did the Romans dispose of the very poor or the slaves or the people who did not get a normal civilized burial. And the best answer at the moment seems to be that they were probably big mass cremation pyres. Now, that's a more expensive and difficult way of disposing of a corpse rather than just chucking it in the ground. But these would at least dispose of it efficiently. There wouldn't be any sort of smells. There wouldn't be any lasting effects. So that is perhaps the solution that the Romans had. And it has to be said, Maecenas, in building his garden and dumping all that earth, was probably doing everybody a favour.
Yeah, I guess you can't be expected to give everybody a nice burial in Rome. They would have had to have churned through a lot of gladiators and slaves and prisoners who were executed. And
yeah, it's a big problem. Where did you put all this stuff? And I mean, even in the imperial period, one of the problems is where do you dispose of all the animals and executed from the Colosseum, from the games? Huge amount of bloodshed, yeah. Yeah, we've got to remember, not everybody got buried in a good way in the ancient world. It still doesn't really happen. If you think most recently of Hart Island in New York and those mass burials that have been carried out at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, and even before then, Hart Island is where the deceased of New York are put when nobody comes forward to claim the body. So it's still going on. It's still a modern problem.
Mm. Kaelin, did you want to go with your last one now?
Yes, so I suppose I'm going to end with Nero and the fire of Rome, which of course blazed for 9 days in July of 64 CE. And the most famous account of this, most extensive, of course, comes from Tacitus in book 15 of his Annals, which is written in the early 2nd century CE. So you're probably talking about 60 years after the events. Tacitus raises the possibility that Nero was responsible for setting the fire of Rome, but he himself doesn't buy into that. He says, you know, he's read authors that give two different versions. One, of course, that Nero is the arsonist, the other that it was an accident, which, of course, is quite logical in a city like Rome. But can we get closer to the time period? Can we find out what people in Nero's reign or shortly after thought? And this is part of my current research about rumour and gossip about Roman emperors, in which I try and investigate our sources as close to the time as possible. This requires a bit of detective work. So we know there was a young senator and poet called Lucan, best known for his surviving work of the civil wars of the late republic, the Pharsalia. Now, we also know that he wrote a poem called De Incendio Urbis on the burning of the city. Now, it doesn't survive, but it was probably composed in the August of 64, shortly after the fire. Now, how do we know that Lucan might have said that Nero started the fire? Well, if we fast forward a bit to the end of the first century CE, a poet called Statius commemorates Lucan's birthday by writing a poem to Lucan's widow, because Lucan unfortunately perished under Nero. He was accused of being a conspirator. And in this poem, the muse Calliope tells the baby Lucan, I will quote, "You will sing of the terrible fires of a criminal master spreading over the rooftops of Remus," unquote, which this suggests that Lucan in his poem said that it was Nero's fault. He is the criminal master or the criminal lord. Now, this may be identical on the burning of the city, may be identical with a reference in this Life of Lucan. So it's one of his lesser known works in his On the Lives of Illustrious Men. Suetonius refers to a slanderous poem which angered Nero. And we know that soon after, Nero did forbid readings of Lucan's poetry. So it may well be that among the literary elite, the senatorial aristocracy, they were attributing the fire to Nero. Our next text, it was probably written not long after Nero's suicide, possibly later in 68 or in 69. And this text does survive. It's a play, a historical play called the Octavia, which has been wrongly attributed to Seneca the Younger. So it's a play about Nero's wife, Octavia, and of course about Nero himself. Whoever wrote it was very well acquainted with the imperial court and the imperial family and the gossip at the court. So the Octavia, despite being written in the late 60s, is set in AD 62, but it offers premonitions of Nero's future evils. And in the play, the character of Nero, enraged at the people of Rome, can be heard wishing that the city's buildings may soon fall under my flames. So he wants to punish the people of Rome by burning the city because of their support for Octavia. Some scholars have suggested that this play may have been written later in the Flavian period. That's probably not the case. The play is anti-Neronian rather than pro-Flavian. So it's probably written quite soon after Nero's suicide. And so people who went to see this play would have also seen it dramatized that Nero was responsible for the Great Fire of Rome. So obviously, you know, Tacitus preserves a wonderful account. We can also look at Cassius Dio and Suetonius as well, but it's good to go back a bit earlier and see how close we can get to the time of events and see what people were talking about then.
So a lot of those plays, if Rome HBO is guiding me correctly, are kind of written about current events as well, which would kind of mean it happened very close to when the fire was, or you know, the death of Nero, I guess.
This is the only one to survive complete, this type of historical drama, a bit of a lost genre. But certainly, you know, it would have its greatest impact within memory if people remembered who Octavia was, you know, if the fire wasn't too long away. I mean, it's been suggested it dates as late as the reign of Domitian, which I cannot agree with.
Interesting detective work. So you've got a poem about a poem and you've got a play. And then that leads you to kind of go, Nero started the fire.
No, it doesn't. it leads me to say that amongst the literary elite, there were people who attributed the fire to Nero. I have to be very careful. For example, Cassius Dio has the ordinary population of Rome running around saying, you know, who started this fire? We don't know. And it's plausible that did happen, but we can't definitely say for certain that ordinary people thought that Nero did it.
In a way, Kaelin, I think you finishing there brought us full circle, because we started off with somebody who had little birthday celebrations to Virgil, and now you've got a poet who had birthday celebrations for Lucan, or wrote Lucan, a poem yes. for him, and also Nero. Nero is just everywhere.
That was myself, along with Rhiannon Evans, Kaelin Davenport, and Gillian Shepherd, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. Our next live show will celebrate Rome's birthday on the 21st of April. You can find out more information on our Facebook page or on our Twitters. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, Gillian is at Lady Trendle, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we continue our story of Roman emperors. We are now in the crisis of the 3rd century, and we recommence with the reign of Gordian III. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.